I was a little late this morning because I wanted to make sure our devotees from Houston had enough time to arrive. That gave me a good excuse. And I also had to do some writing early this morning. Anyway, better late than never. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Agyanatimarandasa Jananjana Salakaya Chaksulamiratam Jena Tasmai Si Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manu Vistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapandantikam Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Chapter 12, Text Number 33. Tat abhipretam alakshya.
Tat abhipretam alakshya.
Brataro chutta choditaha.
Brataro chutta choditaha.
Dhanam prahinam ajahuru.
Dhanam prahinam
ajahur.
Udichyam dishi
brudishaha.
Udichyam dishi
brudishaha. His. Abhipretam, wishes of the mind.
Alakshya,
observing.
Brataraha,
his brothers.
Achutya,
the infallible.
Lord Sri Krishna.
Choditaha,
being advised by.
Dhanam,
riches.
Prahinam,
to collect.
Ajahru,
brought about.
Udichyam,
northern.
Dishi,
direction.
Bhurishaha,
sufficient.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Understanding the hearty wishes of the king, his brothers, as advised by the infallible Lord Sri Krishna, collected sufficient riches from the north left by King Maruta. Purport. Maharaja Maruta, one of the great emperors of the world, he reigned over the world long before the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He was the son of Maharaj Avikshit and was a great devotee of the son of the sun god, known as Yamaraja. His brother, Samvarta, was a rival priest of the great Brihaspati, the learned priest of the demigods. He conducted one sacrifice called Sankara Yajna, by which the Lord was so satisfied that he was pleased to hand over to him the charge of a mountain peak of gold. This peak of gold is somewhere in the Himalaya mountains, and modern adventurers may try to find it there. He was so powerful an emperor that at the day's end of sacrifice, the demigods from the other planets like Indra, Chandra, and Brihaspati used to visit his palace. And because he had the gold peak at his disposal, he had sufficient gold in his possession. The canopy of the sacrificial altar was completely made of gold. In his daily performances of the sacrificial ceremonies, some of the inhabitants of Vayuloka, airy planets, were invited to expedite the cooking work of the ceremony. and the assembly of the demigods in the ceremony was led by Vishvadeva. By his constant pious work, he was able to drive out all kinds of diseases from the jurisdiction of his kingdom. All the inhabitants of higher planets, like Devaloka and Pitriloka, were pleased with him for his great sacrificial ceremonies. Every day he used to give in charity to the learned brahmanas such things as bedding, seats, conveyances, and sufficient quantities of gold. Because of munificent charities and performances of innumerable sacrifices, the king of heaven, Indradeva, was fully satisfied with him and always wished for his welfare. Due to his pious activities, he remained a young man throughout his life and reigned over the world for 1,000 years, surrounded by his satisfied subjects, ministers, legitimate wife, sons, and brothers. Even Lord Sri Krishna praised his spirit of pious activities. He handed over his only daughter to Maharishi Angira, and by his good blessings, he was elevated to the kingdom of heaven. First of all, he wanted to offer the priesthood of his sacrifices to learned Brihaspati, but the demigod refused to accept the post because of the king's being a human being, a man of this earth. He was very sorry for this, but on the advice of Narada Muni, he appointed Samvarta to the post, and he was successful in his mission. The success of a particular type of sacrifice completely depends on the priest in charge. In this age, all kinds of sacrifice are forbidden, because there is no learned priest amongst the so-called brahmanas who go by the false notion of becoming sons of brahmanas without brahminical qualifications. In this age of Kali, therefore, only one kind of sacrifice is recommended, Sankirtana Yajna, as inaugurated by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There are, of course, many interesting points in this purport by Srila Prabhupada. Of course, the background is that the Kurukshetra war had been completed and there was a great loss of lives. The family members of Maharaj Yudhisthira, the king, so many family members had been slaughtered. Not only family members, elders, friends, respectable persons. Practically, this was a huge devastation. Now we, you know, become horrified if a battle ensues and 1,000, 5,000, 50,000, 100,000 persons are killed. It's, you know, considered a great travesty. And in the world wars, millions of persons were killed. But we learn from the Vedas, Vedic literatures, Puranic literatures, that 560 million men were killed. 560 million men. Doesn't mention any women or children. Because the battle was not fought as today's conventional battles are fought. In other words, they didn't bomb out a big city. They didn't drop an atomic bomb, or they didn't shoot a smart bomb, which, you know, kills whoever it happens to hit. The Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, there was a kshetra, a field, set aside for fighting. It was quite civilized. In other words, when you want to fight, you have a field to fight on. When you want to plant grains, you have a field to plant grains on. And when you want to build your house, you have a field where you build houses. People designated different areas for different purposes, just like we designate the body, parts of the body, for specific use and not for other purposes. Although today's, you know, civilization, so-called civilization, cannot figure out what the proper use of the different limbs of the body are. I mean, of course, it's not as foolish as, well, it is getting very foolish. I mean, you can't imagine driving a nail into a piece of wood with your head, right? They haven't come to that foolish point yet. But they are doing some very stupid things, you know, and we will not get into the gory details of it all. But people do not know how to use their bodies properly. Similarly, they don't know the proper purpose for which different rooms in a house are to be utilized. They don't know how to build houses. They build the toilet, the latrine, inside a house, which contaminates the whole house, as an example. And they never used to do this. Outhouses, they were called, right? And people think outhouses are something, you know, very backwards. No one would think of it. You know, you're really impoverished if you have an outhouse. But actually, you're much more civilized if you have an outhouse. So, battles were fought between persons who were fit for fighting. They were trained, designated, and they fought. In any case, this particular battle was a huge fratricidal war in which so many persons lost their lives. So the king who survived and for whom the battle was fought felt guilty. And in order to remove that sense of guilt, he wanted to perform this huge horse sacrifice. And to perform such a sacrifice required vast wealth. Just like today, any type of undertaking requires wealth. What to speak of a huge undertaking, let's say like a state fair or a world's fair. These yajnas were at least like a state fair and probably more like a world's fair. Great personalities were called from all parts of the world, and they had to be housed and, you know, fed and given gifts. I mean, unless someone was extremely wealthy, they could not undertake such a sacrifice. So, in order to perform this sacrifice, the brothers of the king, that means Arjuna and his brothers, knowing his desire and encouraged by Lord Krishna, decided to go out and win wealth. They went to the north, to where King Maruta had been. And this king, Maruta, is basically described here in this purport today. How did he get wealth? It's interesting because nowadays there is no connection drawn between wealth and piety. In fact, it's bewildering to see that some of the most impious persons in the world happen to be the most wealthy. And therefore, wealth and piety are often connected. For example, if you see some type of religious gathering, like an evangelical meeting, or any type of meeting, why should we, why should we specifically, you know, talk about evangelists, anyone for that matter these days? When they testify about God's grace, one of the proofs that God has been blessed or blessing them is that they are wealthy. People show their wealth as a sign of, you know, God's favor. There is, of course, a religious background for this in Christianity, and it comes from Calvin. Calvin was a predestinarian. His idea was that God had already chosen certain people to be elect amongst the elect. Elect meant that they were elected to go to the kingdom of God. They were selected persons. And it was already predestined. It didn't matter what you did. If you were on the list, you know, you were amongst those who were of the elect. And if you weren't on the list, you were considered reprobates or damned. You were going to hell. And that, it was already decided. It didn't matter what you did. Now, someone might say, well, then, it doesn't, you know, what could be the inducement for anyone to do anything? So, of course, Calvin was no fool. And he had to work this out also in his theology. So he concluded that the sign of those who were amongst the elect was, one of the main signs was that they were prosperous. They were very active, and therefore they were very prosperous. So this Calvinist philosophy is actually very significant in terms of what gradually took place in America. Because America was built on this philosophy of prosperity through work as a sign of God's favor. The whole American ethic of work ethic is based on, ultimately and originally, on this philosophy. The Puritans brought it over, and they preserved the same type of mentality. So, there is a basis for this, that if, you know, God favors someone, they have wealth. But what does our Vaishnav philosophy teach? That if God favors someone, what does he do? Takes everything away. So you can imagine why people have so much difficulty understanding, you know, how Krishna consciousness is a worthwhile religion. Here's a religion which runs exactly contrary to the American ethic. American ethic is to be very prosperous. And here's a religion that espouses poverty. It's a very, you know, strange circumstance. And politically, then you have another, you know, very famous philosopher, political philosopher, was Machiavelli. And Machiavelli's view was that you can do anything, the end justifies the means. In political activities, whatever you need to get done to achieve the goal, you can do it. It doesn't matter what it is. So, practically, that has also become the ethic of politics today. Politicians are prepared to do anything they can do as long as they can get away with it. You know, like when someone is caught and asked, what was your crime? He said, my crime is that I got caught. Not that my crime is that I did such and such. My crime is that I got caught. And Machiavelli, his model that he held up was a man, Cesare Borgia, who was an illegitimate son of the Pope, who the Pope made into a huge, powerful politician and businessman. And that was Machiavelli's hero. And someone like St. Francis, who had renounced everything, Machiavelli considered him a fool. So you can see why. That's why in America, for example, there's practically no monasteries. There's no monastic orders in any religious tradition here. Very, very little. It's all based on a completely different principles. And Krishna consciousness, Vaishnavism, is established on a very different system of renunciation, for example, of truthfulness, of piety. And there is a basis, of course, of connection with wealth and piety. Nobody can become wealthy in this lifetime unless having done some great pious merit in the past. Srila Prabhupada points out that a person may do nothing at all and inherit millions of dollars, whereas someone else may work their head off, you know, work their backside off for their whole life and remain a pauper. So it's not a fact that you can simply say that by working hard you can become wealthy. There has to be some, you know, divine intercession as a result of your past actions which leads to your present wealth. So if you find that people are very impious today and yet very wealthy, you should not think that because they're impious they were able to become wealthy. They became wealthy because of some past piousness. And now, due to this wealth, or one of the reasons, or one of the results, consequences of their wealth is that they're acting impiously by misusing that wealth. The wealth has corrupted them. Because we see that there's a connection. Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. These first three, Dharma, Artha, and Kama. Dharma, piety, religious activity, leads to Artha, or wealth. And wealth leads to what? Kama. Sense enjoyment, desires can be fulfilled. So when people get wealth as a result of religiosity, nowadays, because they're not properly trained, what is the result? They use that wealth to purchase sense enjoyment. And so they prepare their path to hell. But actually, it's not meant to be that way, as we see from the example of Maharaj Maruta. There's some quite interesting points here. One thing is that this king was so pious that demigods used to visit him at the end of the day. So there was regular interaction between the inhabitants of this planet and of other planets. Of course, nowadays this is, you know, one of the favorite themes of movies, extraterrestrials. They've just renamed a highway, I think in Arizona, somewhere called E.T. Highway. And they opened a restaurant there called, it's spelled like this, A apostrophe L-E, capital I-N-N. It's an inn where people can eat and drink. It's called Alien. L-E-N. Yeah, something like that. Alien. On E.T. Highway. Because they say that this place, they've had more sightings of extraterrestrials on this highway than cars on the highway. In other words, it's a deserted place, you know, that it's a God-forsaken place, so that's where they think extraterrestrials will land. Anyway, that may or may not be, but the fact is the Bhagavatam describes that there are persons from other planets who land on this planet, and they don't look weird. Someone was telling a story the other day about how there was an old television series called The Twilight Zone. And in one of the programs, you know, you see these two persons who are covered with sheets, and they're undergoing an operation because they're hideous, hideous creatures. And finally the operation fails, and at the end of the show, you know, they drop their sheets and you see they're two beautiful looking people. And then you suddenly see all of the doctors and everyone else, and they're these hideous creatures. So everybody has this concept that, you know, we are the beautiful persons and the persons on other planets are hideous monsters. But in this, of course, Twilight Zone thing, the persons who we consider monsters consider themselves normal, and the, you know, this type of appearance, you know, blonde hair, blue-eyed, etc., was considered the monster. Of course, you know, the real fact is that there is some sense of beauty amongst human beings, and the hideous monsters that all of these motion picture makers imagine are really the monsters of their minds and probably what they will become in future lifetimes. You know, it's not that Krishna cannot create new species. He can. And considering some of the sinfulness that these people are committing, you know, there may have to be some new species created in order to fulfill such, you know, dastardly karma as the people of this planet are working out. These demigods were very beautiful. They are very beautiful. And they do exist, and they did visit this king. And they blessed the king. You can see. They helped him to perform his sacrifice. The demigods from Vayuloka expedited the cooking by, you know, blowing air or something, or creating favorable breezes for the fires. And Vishvadeva led the ceremony. So they were being assisted in so many ways. In his kingdom, no disease. His pious work drove out all kinds of disease from the jurisdiction of his kingdom. That's a very interesting, another interesting connection. Nobody relates. Well, they do to some extent, but how do you relate disease to piety? Of course, there's some sense of this. I mean, there is and there isn't. There are connections between religiousness and illness and hospitals. You know, traditionally, hospitals were also looked over by people who were, you know, church people, etc. And sometimes we see diseases were considered to be, in the old days, you know, God would send disease down on those who disobeyed his commandments. But nowadays, there's no such connection. People don't connect these. They just think, you know, disease? Okay. You know, we'll get him. We'll figure out a cure for it. Nobody would think that, why doesn't the United States president, you know, sit down and start chanting Hare Krishna? Or, you know, do some religious activity as the head of the country, and maybe things will improve. That's what they would have done. As soon as there was some disease, what to speak of widespread epidemic disease, and people can't see that this is national karma. One epidemic disease after another is attacking the population, and they just, you know, it's just material cause. No one can trace out the religious connection, the spiritual connection. But it was very clear to the people of the Vedic times. The king's foremost duty was to keep the citizens peaceful, which meant healthy in body and mind, so that they could execute their spiritual purpose of life. And for this purpose, the king executed sacrifices daily. And the result was no disease in the kingdom. No disease. In fact, we read in Krishna book that when one person's son died, you know, suddenly, the king immediately went to Maharaj Yudhisthira and Arjuna and complained. And said, you have no business being the king. My son died. How is it possible that my son could die? Well, he didn't die in a battle. He died of natural causes. That is unnatural, to die of natural causes before his father. A son should not outlive his father. And he said, I want my son back. Or you don't deserve to be king. Can you imagine? I mean, that means that in one sense we laugh at the legal system today, that you can sue someone for almost anything. But look at what was going on then. You could attach legally the king to any misfortune that happened in the kingdom of any type, small or great. It was the king's fault. Now, can you imagine the responsibility that went with the position of being a king? Nowadays, people want positions of leadership, but they're not capable, or nor willing, nor do they know what responsibilities are connected with the position that they occupy. And it's not just kings. It's fathers, mothers, teachers. You practically can name any position. People are no longer properly qualified. This is Kali Yuga. So here we have examples. We are reading the Bhagavatam daily. Why? To re-educate ourselves, or really to educate ourselves for the first time, because we did not receive this education. I wonder, as I see parents, now, just mention a point, that so many parents take their children out of our gurukul, you know, at an early age. Do they educate the children at home in the way that the children do get educated at our gurukul? I wonder if they do. Otherwise, what kind of education are you giving your children? You take your children out of the gurukul at a young age. I can understand when the children grow up. You know, we may not be able to give them the complete education they can get once they're older. But at least, you know, until they're 10 or 12, whatever, 14, you know, it seems to me that children's character is molded. And you can't expect that it's only going to be molded when they come, you know, occasionally to the temple, because I don't see the children coming and sitting in classes. So if they don't get spiritually educated at Gurukul, do the parents give them that education? Do you make up for it? Because if you don't, then how will this education be given? Then we're simply going to reproduce, you know, Varna Sankara, unwanted population. Children, grown-ups who do not know what it means to be responsible. Note how the king was willing to give in charity to the learned Brahmins such things as beddings, seats, conveyances, and sufficient quantities of gold. And because he performed sacrifice for the Brahmins and for the demigods, everything that he wished for the welfare of himself and his state was looked after. So serving Brahmins, serving Vaishnavas, serving cows, we don't get that chance very much. We can't serve any cows. You're not allowed to keep a cow, right? I think it's against the law to keep a cow in the city. You can keep a dog, but you can't keep a cow. Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's the only shape that the cows come in today, hamburgers. The only place you can see a cow is on your is on your dinner plate. That's how sad the state of affairs is. Note, that due to his pious activities, he remained a young man throughout his life. Do you notice how when they take photographs of the President of the United States, when he enters office and when he leaves office? And they always remark, he became, you know, he aged 20 years in 4 years. And here we find, due to his pious activities, he remained a young man throughout his life. No aging. He remained youthful. Sometimes people know how the devotees look ever youthful. Now, you can say that's because they don't have any worries. They don't take... We should not think it's because they take no responsibility. If it is for that reason, that's not a very good statement. But if a devotee takes lots of responsibility, but still does not worry, that is a good sign. Not that we take no responsibility and therefore we have no worries. We take plenty of responsibility, but because of Krishna consciousness, we have no anxiety. And he reigned over the world for 1,000 years, surrounded by satisfied subjects, ministers, legitimate wives, sons, and brothers. In Italy, they say how many times the government changed? Something like, I think it's unbelievable. Something like in the last 40 years, the government has changed 50 or 60 times. Here, one government for 1,000 years. Nobody desiring to change it. The king was just like the, you know, he was the greatest well-wisher of the people. He handed over his only daughter to Maharishi Angira, and by his good blessings, he was elevated to the kingdom of heaven. Note how he felt he wanted Brihaspati to be his priest. He refused because the king was a human being, a man of this earth. Again, another reversal. Human beings consider themselves the pinnacle of the evolutionary process, right? And here we find that this human being, who was the best human being on this planet, was rejected for being low class. Again, you know, this is a very, very different system. A very different standard was understood in those days. Human beings were not considered to be the highest achievement of evolution. They were somewhere in the middle, not more. The planet Earth is said to be in the middle of the universe. So there are higher planetary systems, as many above as below, and they're all more elevated than ours. And that is only 1/4 of the creation. That doesn't take into account the spiritual world, which is so much more evolved. So human beings are not at all the most evolved. They're somewhere, you know, on the lower half of the primate ladder. So Brihaspati refused to become the priest, and the king became sorry and was advised by Narada Muni not to be disappointed. So even a very highly qualified person will sometimes become disappointed, but by association with saintly persons, his equipoise, his equanimity was restored. Finally, it mentions here that the sacrifice which was performed depended entirely on the qualification of the priests. And as we pointed out two or three Saturdays ago, if we had to depend upon the qualification of priests for sacrifice, there would be no possibility of yajna. I won't remind you of what I said the other day to avoid embarrassment of the parties involved. There's only one sacrifice possible in this age, and that is Sankirtan Yajna. Just see how good this yajna is, how feasible it is. What qualification does one require to perform Sankirtan? Simply sincerity, nothing more. Some determination. Simply determination. We can just, consider the point that in this day and age, people are not at all determined. Very little determination for spiritual life. But actually determination, if it is pursued, if something is pursued, gradually there will be success. We heard the story told the other day about two frogs who slipped into a bucket or a huge vat of milk. And one of them got tired, gave up trying to get out and drowned. But the other one kept flipping his flippers, and gradually the milk became solidified and turned into butter, and then the frog hopped out. This example is given to show determination. If a Sankirtan devotee just will keep flipping back and forth, going and meeting each person and requesting them, please take a book, please take a book, please take a book, gradually he will or she will advance in spiritual life. So, Sankirtan is feasible. It does not require any previous qualification. It's not that you have to be a Brahmin to do Sankirtan. It's not that you have to be clean, unclean, fit, unfit. You can be in any situation whatsoever. But if you have the sincere desire to glorify Krishna, and originally that glorification was simply by chanting. That was the primary form of Sankirtan that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu inaugurated. But knowing the circumstances of this age, Srila Prabhupada, under the guidance of his Guru Maharaj, has broadened the understanding of Sankirtan and especially focused it on book distribution. Prabhupada has very, very specifically done this for a reason. Because, as he said, the Brihat Mridanga, the printing press, will be heard to a much greater extent than the drums that we make, even if they are made of, fiberglass. They're not any louder. They just aren't any louder. Even we see at beaten at their best, the way the Manipuris did it, right? How many people came? You have to consider this point. Some we did television advertising, radio advertising, and all kinds of, word of mouth advertising, and not more than 150, 200 people came. One book distributor, single-handedly, on the street in 8 hours, can do more than all of that put together. Now, you can see that Prabhupada knew what he was doing. Prabhupada said, you should understand, in this age, people don't come to the temple. You have to bring the temple to the people. So he encouraged us to go out on Sankirtan for a very, very good reason. He pushed this book distribution, saying this was the way that we would be able to expand the glories of the Lord. So, in this age of Kali, therefore, only one kind of sacrifice is recommended, Sankirtana Yajna, as inaugurated by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But we'll stop here and ask if there are any questions or comments. Good. It's late, and we should get an early start. Is there some program today? What street festival?
Fry Street Festival.
Are devotees going there?
Yes.
Okay, if anyone has some free time today, they can go out to, they can, what, get fried on Fry Street. Go to Fry Street, have a nice day there, do some chanting. What will be our program there?
Prasadam.
Three or four in the afternoon. All right. So try to go out and if you can. It's Saturday. You can't claim that most of you are not working. You can make a family outing. Go to Denton. When's the last time you visited Denton? Go to Denton. There'll be prasadam, right? Kirtan, there's probably a nice lake there. Is there a lake on the way? Ah, there's a lake on the way. You get swimming. All right. Hare Krishna.